I don't get it. Maybe say da-da-ba-da-da, don't get it. I get stupefied. I get stupefied, right?
Alright, all you movie junkies. It is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome once again to another fantastic episode of the SLS Cast. We are on episode 61, the Pronghorn Antelope episode. Now, how the fuck did I come up with that? See, you're already snickering. I think you like this. I really do. Here it is. Back in 1936, a dude by the name of Arthur Einarsson, who did a book on pronghorn antelope and its management, happened to clock the maximum speed of a pronghorn antelope at, that's right, folks, 61 miles per hour. And on that weak note, I am Matt.
And I am Tim. I don't really know how to back that up. Surely that's not information that you have known of prior to this episode. Or was it? Was it something that you've always known? And we're just waiting for 61.
Yes, I am the Encyclopedia Britannica. All right, I just have this retarded shit in my head at all times. I am your phone a friend in the event of you being on Millionaire. It's one of the many services I provide to those in my inner circle.
Well, I don't want to let you down, Matt, but I don't think I'm going to be on Millionaire anytime soon.
Well, it's okay. Whether or not you can get on Millionaire has absolutely nothing to do with whether or not I would be your phone a friend should you find yourself on Millionaire, as it were.
You would be. Don't worry.
Oh, yay. So, how was your week? What'd you think of the Super Bowl shit?
It was shit. You said it for me. I like the Seahawks. I'm glad they won. It was, I think, even if you were not a Super Bowl fan, a football fan, for that matter, it was one big cohesive, like, slap to the head, like, how ridiculous this game was. Because even, like, the announcers, I think for the first Super Bowl ever, really, announcers were actually calling the game, the winners of the game, before the game was even over, like, during halftime, I believe.
Given that I work in the pizza industry, I had to work, so I didn't even see the game. And the little bits that I was catching and everything, I got about most of the way through the first quarter, maybe a little bit into the second, and I was like, ha ha ha, the Broncos are going to lose. Which I was kind of disappointed about, because I'm not exactly a Sea Chickens fan. So, you know, that's fine. Hey, my parents are big Sea Chickens fans, and that's good on them.
Do you have something about their neon green jerseys?
No, I just never really cared for them. I mean, yeah. just never been my cup of tea. And that's okay. It's fine if people do want to like them. I don't know. I just seemed like it wasn't really grabbing my interest. They were already starting to build up too much momentum. I think Denver basically expected them to play like they had played in their championship game.
Mm-hmm.
And they instead shifted their strategy, and I don't think the Broncos could ever get their momentum up. Which is fine. It's whatever. But there was something that I thought was pretty interesting that I wanted to share with you. It's news, but it's not. It's just kind of funny news. This comes to us from Fox 31 in Denver, KDVR.com.
Ooh.
Yes, furniture store loses more than $7 million in Super Bowl bet. What caught me when I saw that, I was like, as soon as I saw that little tagline, I was like, man, I bet you that's Mattress Mac. And I click on it, and sure enough, a Houston furniture store lost $7 million Sunday after running a Super Bowl promotion that would give big spending customers their money back if the Seattle Seahawks won the game. Jim Mattress Mac Mackingvale said that he would give a refund to customers who spent $6,000 or more at Gallery Furniture in the 2 weeks leading up to the game. When the Seahawks throttled the Denver Broncos on Sunday, Mackingvale confirmed he would deliver on his promise, giving back more than $7 million to about 1,000 customers.
Hi, folks. Mattress Mack here at Gallery Furniture. Every day I hear lots of horror stories from customers who bought at other furniture stores and had a terrible experience. They were very, very disappointed. Customers tell me that other stores take 8 to 10 weeks to deliver furniture. Sometimes it's still not there. Horrible stories about not ever getting a refund, etc., etc. Well, folks, if you want a happy ending rather than a horror story, come out to Gallery Furniture and you'll see me at the front. We'll get you the furniture you want. We'll have it delivered tonight. And most of all, Gallery Furniture will keep our promise, delight you, and save you money today.
Yikes.
Yes. Quote, the
he
accountant...
He will literally save you money.
Yeah. The accountant... Quote, the accountant is pulling his hair out this morning, but the customers are happy and that's what's most important. End quote. So I just thought that was kind of fun that someone... You know, a big local business here made the news in Denver and probably elsewhere in the United States. And other than that, though, I mean, nothing really fun and exciting has happened to me, except I finally went and did it. I upgraded my collection of movies, and they now include the Blu-ray special edition box set crap, whatever, of The Godfather trilogy. The Scarface, which came, you know, which actually has the 1932 version bundled in with it.
Along you got the limited edition 10 version?
Yes.
Like the 10 outside with the cards? It came with the cards?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then Goodfellas, Casino, and...
Already, that's enough, like, gun violence, death, and language to fill one's lifetime with.
Well, indeed, but I wanted to have... The ultimate, and The Untouchables. There we go. The Kevin Costner one. I decided I didn't have enough Robert De Niro in my life. No, I wanted to, I just was kind of inspired when Amazon had a sale on a one-day sale on the Godfather collection. And it's it was the Blu-ray set. It's normally like $70 or whatever like that. And it was on sale for $16.99. And I was like, there is just absolutely no way that I can pass up. And this was the Coppola Restoration Edition and the whole nine yards, four discs, whatever. And I was like, there's just no way that I can pass this up. So I went ahead and bought it. I'm like, well, if I'm going to go ahead and get it, then I got to get Goodfellas and Casino. I mean, that just has to happen if I'm going to do that. And you know what? If I'm going to go ahead and just get this set of movies, then I may as well go ahead and round out the true gangster set of movies and include Scarface and The Untouchables. And so I got I just put the whole kit and caboodle all on Blu-ray. And the best part was that it was less than $50.
Well, if we are all talking about our Blu-ray collection, I recently got in from Amazon. I had the Criterion edition of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World that they released. And it came with, it's two Blu-rays and three DVDs. And it is awesome. It has like the original movie, and then it has the Roadshow movie, which is 25 minutes of additional material added into the original movie that was cut out because they were worried that nobody was actually going to watch a 4-hour long movie. Those of you who do not follow the show, which is probably more than most people that listen to the show, which is the listener.
That's right. For all the listener trying out the show for the first time.
Exactly. It's the all-star comedy cast. It's hilarious. Big, crazy romp. There would not have been a rat race without It's a Mad, 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 Mad World in. I'd definitely highly suggest that one to be added to your collection. Faux show. But, hey, I went to Disneyland this past weekend. That was fun and exciting.
You don't strike me as a Disneyland kind of guy.
Well, apparently doing a Disneyland right is going there on a Thursday in January. Because nobody's
enough.
There.
There was nobody there. Now, did you do the combo pack where you went, the park hopper, where you went to California Adventure and Disneyland proper, or did you just stick to the...
Oh, hey, I did both. California Adventure made the experience for me. There's more things to do there than I originally thought, and they didn't have the big Disneyland fireworks show, the Mickey Mouse Spectacular, whatever, but at California Adventure, they have this thing called the Magical World of Color, or the Wonderful World of Color, something kooky like that, and it is the most exciting water light show I've ever seen. And I haven't seen many, but I imagine that this is up there with all the other water light shows that are famous around the world. But hey, it's great. I totally recommend it. It's weird. They have like an actual pier there and a dock and a San Francisco kind of like feel to it. It's really, really neat. And the entire California Adventure Park is kind of a hat tip to Walt Disney when he first arrived in California back in the early to mid... Excuse me. Wow, it's getting actually worse every time I try to clear my throat. When he arrived in the early 1900s, So it's just, as you're walking through the park, you're just hearing this early 1900s, you know, jazz era, big band kind of music playing in the background. So it's really cool. And all the rides kind of fit into that era as well. So, you know, if you're ever in California, you got to check it out. It's pretty neat.
The expansion of the boardwalk area, the San Francisco boardwalk, which is definitely a 20s, 30s vibe, which is exactly what it's supposed to have. And the addition of Cars Land, and then this wonderful World of Color, which is the next step in the evolution of that misting water stuff that they had, that that Fantasmic's based on.
Mm-hmm.
Disney's California Adventure is starting to pull more traffic than Disneyland.
Oh, I bet.
And so now they're looking at seriously starting to revamp Disneyland at this point and see what they can do about it. I, as a Disney-file, I follow this stuff religiously because I apparently have nothing better to do with my life. And so I am very excited that someone that I know now has gone and experienced this stuff and has such amazing things to say, because this will maybe pull me out of my malaise of wanting to go to Disneyland and actually go at some point.
Yeah, you definitely have to go to the original. Got to do it. There's a lot of little bitty things there that, you being a Disney-file, you'd be able to go and find all the hidden gems that a lot of people overlook when they're in the park.
And I already do that as well whenever I go to Disney World, which is fun. And now we've got Avatar Land, which is official. It is official. Groundbreaking happened 2 weeks ago, I want to say. I think it's like 2 weeks ago tomorrow. And it's... so it's coming, folks. Probably about 2017 when it's all said and done.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, Camp Minnie Mickey is no more, and Avatar Land is going in.
Oh, yeah, and in the Peter Pan ride line, yes, I think the longest line I was in was for the Peter Pan ride. I saw the button people there. Your button friends were there. The collectible button guys.
Oh,
with pin vests.
Pin traders?
Yeah, yeah. They're there, too. I was proud because I would have thought, like, what are these guys doing? And then now that I know, and I mean, they probably thought I was weird because I kept like pointing to them and like talking to Chelsea about them. And
you know. Well, I'm glad that, you know, see, it's all paying it forward.
I cracked their code, apparently.
Nice. All right. Well, I guess we should probably, without any further ado, go ahead and jump into, if you're ready, are you ready?
Yes, I am ready.
Then here we go, ladies and gentlemen. The news! Not snooze, but news. What do you got for us, sir?
It's amazing how, after years of drinking craft brew, and for the Super Bowl, I went out and bought a 30-pack of Bud Light that nobody drank except me. It just goes down like water. Water a little bit tastier than water. Actually, no, I've had water that tasted better than Bud Light, which I guess is a relatively common notion. All right, so first off, to start off my news, are the passings that have happened. The first one is being of Arthur Rankin. He was 89 years old. Along with producer and director Jules Bass, he created the classic holiday TV specials that we have all come to know and love. He was the animator, producer, director on Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Frosty the Snowman. Rankin and Bass also did Thundercats, as well as the animated film The Last Unicorn, and I think that was in 1982. Arthur Rankin, prolific guy right there. Especially in pop culture now, it's amazing how, you know, with our generations just referencing Silver and Gold and The Dentist and all that stuff just kind of keeps coming up. The next passing was Maximilian Schell. He was 83-year-old German actor who is best known for his performance as the German defense attorney in the film Judgment of Nuremberg. That was a Stanley Kramer movie. He won an Oscar for it. He actually got his start in Germany, where he performed in many German films. He left Hollywood in 1958, and he was also nominated for The Man in the Glass Booth in 1975, as well as Julia in 1977. And then finally, Philip Seymour Hoffman passed away this past week. Actually, this past Sunday morning, he was 46 years old. He was found dead in his Greenwich Village, New York apartment due to a deadly heroin overdose. Now, we all last saw him in last year's The Hunger Games movie, but it turns out he was actually just at Sundance promoting two movies that he was in, one being God's Pocket and the other one entitled A Most Wanted Man. Casting was underway for his directorial follow-up to 2010's Jack Goes Boating, called Ezekiel Moses, and they just casted Jake Gyllenhaal as well as Amy Adams as the leads. Now, his character of, Plutarch Havensby? Is that right? Plutarch?
Plutarch.
Plutarch!
Yes.
Havensby. Now, he'll be returning in the final two Hunger Games movie, and that's Mockingjay Part 1 and Mockingjay Part 2. Though his passing will not have any impact on the release dates, but it turns out that he still had one final crucial scene to shoot for Mockingjay Part 2. And now that scene will have to be reconceived, says the studios. Hoffman left behind a wife and three kiddos. Man, that's a horrible shame. And it's crazy because he was, 23 years sober, and then he relapsed last year?
Yeah, and then bam.
Yeah, dead.
It's ridiculous. I mean, it truly is ridiculous. And it's interesting, though, there is one thing I'd like to tie into that about the Hunger Games. There is a companion piece for that called from Grantland.com. And this was courtesy of Zach Dionne, who heavily quotes the Hollywood Reporter, or not quotes, but credits the Hollywood Reporter in his piece. There was some other stuff, though, because they're talking about now how they have the ability to do placement and stuff, and they can get body doubles. They don't actually have to show his face. They can just have his voice talking and talking to the people and showing who he's talking to. So that they have ways to recreate the scene. There was something that was noted in there that there are predictions that in the future, insurance companies may require actors in big films to be scanned and have a range of facial expressions recorded in advance in case something like this happens. And I think that that's kind of interesting to see where technology is going to be able to take us when tragedy strikes. I thought that was kind of an interesting side note there on that. And I do have to add, as a personal, not really a personal side, but there has been some discussion, and this is something that I had brought up before we started recording tonight, but you have people like Corey Monteith, who also died of a drug overdose, and then you have Philip Seymour Hoffman, who died of a drug overdose. And you look and you say, yes, they're both tragedies, and they're both just a waste. But there are people who seem to be more upset by Philip Seymour Hoffman's death versus Corey Monteith's death. And I guess you could say, I mean, one person's body of work was definitely greater. There is no question of that, and that's going to be in the latter here. However, I have to wonder, and it's been pointed out that, is he no less of a... Some people have literally used the word scumbag, because he did. He died, he's left his young kids. And then, of course, there are people who are like, oh, it's a disease and everything, but hey, he was sober for 23 years, so what gives? What does it say? Is it a fair question to ask? What does it say that someone does when someone does overdose? And there are people who are like, when you relapse at what you remember your last dosage was. And when you go 23 years, or in this case, like a year, you go and it's very easy to overdose because you take too much because you think that's what you need to get high. And your body does eventually recover. And there are people who are speculating that's what happened here. I don't know. It's kind of hard because, man, I really am sad because the world has been deprived of this talent. And yet, I'm kind of mad because, yes, I get it. Addiction's a disease and, I don't know. Nothing's anybody's fault or something. I don't know. Just kind of gets to me in some regards on that. But is there ever a time to say, man, what a waste?
Depending who you're talking to, it's a shame. And unfortunately, he's always had a problem with his self-image. He knows that he puts his dark side into these characters, and he always plays characters that have some kind of deeper fault to them. And it's a little bit more, I think, emotional involving for himself, because he's taking bits and pieces of himself and putting them into these characters. And I don't know, I guess he's just depressed and was sad that's why he's noticed, that's why he's known for, are playing these characters that are in some ways representations of himself. And I'm getting this from like various interviews and stuff that I've seen since he passed away. Yeah, it's a sad thing, and it's a shame that he had to resort to something this drastic and this bad. So
sure, and again, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to disparage the guy or his memory or Cory Monteith or Heath Ledger or anybody else who has either purposely or even accidentally taken their own life. I mean, everybody's in their own space and in their own head. I guess I'm just trying to search for a better realm of meaning. And maybe there is none. Maybe there is none. So we'll have a little bit more time to talk about that in more in depth next week, because we are going to be doing a Three Squared next week. A little spoiler alert for the rest of the show. Our Three Squared next week is going to be about Philip Seymour Hoffman. So we're going to do our favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman movies, and then of course have a little bit of a discussion on him anyway. So we might be able to find a little bit more material and hopefully answer some more questions. At any rate, now that I've taken us on like a 3-minute offshoot.
Okay, so Woody Allen. All right, there's more in-depth stuff over this Woody Allen, Dylan Farrow controversy that's, you know, resurfacing and surfacing. All this new stuff is coming out, and all the old stuff is coming back out. As we all know, or I guess some of us know, that Dylan Farrow is the adopted daughter of both Woody Allen and Mia Farrow. And she wrote a first-person account of how she was sexually assaulted by Woody Allen at the age of 7. And this was published in the New York Times. For those of you who don't know, which I'd be surprised, Woody Allen is nominated for directing and writing Blue Jasmine. It's nominated for a handful of Academy Awards. So it's kind of interesting that all this stuff is coming out now when he's having publicity. But anyways, she said this, quote, "When I was 7 years old, Woody Allen took me by the hand and led me into a dim, closet-like attic on the second floor of our house. He told me to lay on my stomach and play with my brother's electric train set. Then he sexually assaulted me. Woody Allen was never convicted of any crime. That he got away with what he did to me haunted me as I grew up. That torment was made worse by Hollywood. All but a precious few, my heroes, turned a blind eye. Most found it easier to accept the ambiguity, to say, who can say what happened, to pretend that nothing was wrong. Actors praised him at award shows. Networks put him on TV. Critics put him in magazines." End quote. Dylan Farrow also called upon actors and actresses that were in Blue Jasmine to consider, quote, "What if it had been your child?" End quote. Woody Allen's rep stated that Mr. Allen has read the article and found it untrue and utterly disgraceful. He will be responding very soon. End quote. Sony Classics is their distributor, says that, quote, "We've had a long, productive, and rewarding relationship with Mr. Allen. This is a very complicated situation and a tragedy for everyone involved. Mr. Allen has never been charged in relationship to any of this, and therefore deserves our presumption of innocence." The star of the popular cable show Girls, Lena Dunham, tweeted the article along with a caption that she wrote, quote, "To share in this way is courageous, powerful, and generous." End quote. Woody Allen's lawyer, Elkin Arbonowitz, told NBC's Today Show that, quote, "Dylan was a pawn in a huge fight between Woody Allen and Mia Farrow years ago, and the idea that she was molested was implanted in her by her mother, and that'd be Mia Farrow. And that memory is never going to go away. So the fact that she says this now, that it happened 20 years ago, is totally understandable." End quote. So, as you can see, it's kind of a dividing line. It's not a lot of people saying, maybe it's either, you know, this girl is courageous for doing this, we should support her. Other people are put in this awkward situation because they're currently working with him, or want to work with him, or have respect for him, or even actually believe him, and that are saying, you know, something's a little fishy, you know, it's a little bit fishy that all this is kind of happening now, and not, let's say, a year ago or 2 years ago. So what do you think, Matt? Do you think this could possibly have been something planted within her mind by Mia Farrow many years ago?
Yes, I believe it is possible. They have had instances where children have been coached, not hypnotized or anything, but literally they've been coached or asked leading questions that then lead them to believe, oh, well, maybe that did happen, and especially at a very young age. Now, is that what happened here? Who can say? But the problem becomes, no matter what, two people's lives are destroyed. Woody Allen, whether or not he did this, and I am in the camp of you must be vigilant about these things, but you have to remember innocent until proven guilty. You must remember innocent until proven guilty, because even an allegation could destroy someone's life. On the other hand, you have someone who, for whatever reason, is pursuing this, whether or not it's 20 years too late, I don't know. But they either A, genuinely believe this, or B, they are so vindictive that they are going to go after someone else over something like this. So you've got two people whose lives are in virtual forever turmoil, because Woody Allen, if he is innocent, regardless of his adopted daughter, former adopted daughter, whatever, at this point, either being vindictive or being duped or had it really happen, and maybe she just thinks it's him, I don't know, he'll have to look over his shoulder for the rest of his life. Wow, man, is the next person I meet going to think that I'm some kind of freak? Do my friends really support me? Or are they just looking out for their own careers? Does anybody really believe me? Anything like that. I mean, that goes on. And then, of course, you have this girl here who believes her life has been destroyed and is being frustrated at every turn and can't get anybody to believe her. And you've got two people whose lives are destroyed. And that is what makes this scenario all the more worse for everyone involved. But that's why you've got to be innocent until proven guilty. I think if she can do it, if there's a way for her to do it, she should go ahead and pursue it. She should get it and take it and take him to court and do what she needs to do. Let it be sorted out. At that point, at least then you've got stuff that will no longer be innuendo, deflections, stuff. It'll be there. It'll be on the record. And if it comes down that he did something, well, then we'll know. And if it comes out that it comes down that he didn't do anything, then by God, we'll know for sure. But this is just a devastating scenario.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And I just also want to note that Quentin Tarantino and Mia Farrow split... Or not Quentin Tarantino. Wow, that would have been a weird relationship. Woody Allen and Woody Farrell... God damn it. Woody Allen and... Woody Allen and Mia Farrow split up because of these sexual allegations from the early 90s. They've been apart from each other for quite a while now due to all the stuff that's been kind of going on with him. All right, okay, so the Academy Award nominations, I remember going through looking at all of them whenever they were first posted, and one of them, it was in the nominated songs category, and the song was entitled Alone Yet Not Alone. And I was doing a little bit of research on the IMDb, and this movie came up, and it had a 3.4 rating, star rating on IMDb. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because I have never heard of this movie. I couldn't find anything anywhere about this movie, but yet somehow a song from this movie is nominated for an Academy Award. Didn't even listen to it. I just thought that was kind of interesting. Didn't even think anything about it until a week or so ago, when I heard about this this story. And it turns out that the Oscar-nominated song, Alone Yet Not Alone, written by Bruce Broughton and Dennis Spiegel, has been revoked. The nomination has been revoked because Broughton, who was the writer, lobbied the music branch members of the Academy Awards via email while voting was actually taking place. Broughton was also, turns out, a former representative of the music branch on the Academy Awards Board of Governors. The Merry Band of Governors. No, they were the Merry Board of Governors. So that's kind of interesting there. So you're not going to be seeing the nominated song Alone Yet Not Alone. What sucks is that, you know, another song that was possibly just as good or even better that could have been nominated and possibly could have won Of course, he's playing stupid, saying that, oh yeah, you know, I thought I was just trying to help out my movie. No, you know what you were doing. You thought you could just trust all these guys to not rat you out, you little sneaker, you little mouseketeer.
I saw something about that. I have some vocally conservative family members, and of course, you know, everybody has them, right? One way or the other, vocally liberal. At any rate, I got this email saying that basically the Academy was doing this because they were like Christians or something like that. So I go and I look it up, and so I'm like, okay, wait a minute, what's going on here? Let's just see, because we don't want people getting all uppity for no reason. And then I find out that it was indeed with the email thing. So my only question is, how did they not find out about the email thing? Aren't they supposed to be doing due diligence on this stuff? I mean, don't violations come out before? Does that not make sense? Like, this, it's been nominated. It comes out that it's been nominated. It's posted on the websites everywhere that this is what the Academy has nominated. I mean, don't they look for rules violations before they make the nominations?
Well, I mean,
that's a legit question. I'm seriously wanting to know.
There could be an investigation, you know? So that's a possibility. An investigation into the issue. Because even the corporate world, apparently, of what I've experienced with my many temp jobs, and I'm sure you have also, and I think now it's become more of a thing instead of just firing somebody because they've heard a rumor, or even if there is a fact, they have to do some kind of like probing and investigative work to make sure all of this is true and all that stuff. But I think, and more importantly, it kind of raises a couple other questions that I wonder how often this does happen and actually doesn't get noticed. And I think it's kind of amazing that it was able to happen. And that's kind of like what you were saying, is that why wasn't this found out earlier on? And maybe it's because maybe they were just kind of doing an investigation on it, wanting to make sure before stuff got out of hand for no reason, I suppose.
Yeah, and again, that's just the only question that I have, is why is it only coming out after the nomination that a rule was broken? And clearly the rule was broken because the guy's owning up and saying, I broke the rule. So, I mean, this is not like it's, you know, hate bashing on any particular group or any particular person or anything. I was just kind of curious myself as to why it took so long. So anyways, yes, question everything. But why should I question everything? Okay, so in the news of the weird from citypress.co.za, the entertainment section, courtesy of Charles Blignot, we have Die Antwoord's Ninja is pure evil. Basically, we have the guy who did Elysium and District 9. What is it? Blomkamp, right? Yeah, Neil Blomkamp.
Blomkamp, I think it's...
Blomkamp, yeah. Sure. Yeah, there we go. That's definitely sound. Since there's not two O's, that would probably work, right? Okay, so Neil Blomkamp, because I can read, has had some serious issues with this guy. He was supposed to... This guy made life such a living hell that he was written out of the scene in this new movie called Chappie, which seems to be about a robot. I'm not sure exactly how all this is going to work out, but yeah, Hugh Jackman was flying in to do some scenes where he was supposed to have a scene with this ninja character, and this guy is like a rapper from another country, and they literally wrote him out so that Hugh Jackman wouldn't have to deal with him. Because they were so tired of this guy's shit. So it's an interesting piece. Go ahead, check it out if you want to check it out. Next up for me is a quick list here. This is 10 movies that Roger Ebert really hated. And he was definitely not one to mince words on anything that he liked or didn't like. And so whether or not you agree with him, here's the list and here's the number of stars that he gave. Armageddon, 1 star. The Brown Bunny, 0 stars. Jason X, 0.5 star. And there are little blurbs next to each one of these things, but I'll let you go and read them. This comes to us from mentalfloss.com, by the way, courtesy of Stacy Conrad. Mad Dog Time, 0 stars. The Usual Suspects, I was blown away by this one. The Usual Suspects, 1.5 stars. Deuce Bigelow, European Gigolo, 0 stars. Which, if you remember back from when we had talked about this a long time ago, Ebert and, oh good lord, Rob Schneider did apparently connect later on. He basically told Schneider that, I didn't hate it that much, but it's not that bad. Or basically, it was still a bad movie, but maybe he was a little harder on it than he needed to be. So whatever, for whatever that's worth. Number 7, North, 0 stars. Number 8, Spice World, half star. Number 9, Good Luck Chuck, 1 star. And finally on the list, Freddy Got Fingered. I've never met anyone who likes that movie.
Daddy, do you want some sausage? Daddy, would you like some sausage?
Daddy, would you like some... With the whole string, yeah. Okay. Next up for me, from DCComicsNews.com, courtesy of Eric Thompson, Warner Brothers is rebranding Man of Steel sequel. With a, it's pretty cool. They've got some pictures of it up here if you want to check it out. It's the Superman logo, but inlaid into the Batman logo, which is pretty cool. But apparently, all is not well in the world of the Caped Crusader and Superman, as it were. Forbes is reporting that Warner Brothers is rebranding the sequel, and Warner released a statement stating the following, quote, "The new film is currently being written by Chris Terrio from a screenplay by David S. Goyer. Charles Roven and Deborah Snyder are producing with Benjamin Melanaker, Michael E. Uslan, Wesley Collier, David S. Goyer, and Jeff Johns serving as executive producers." That basically means is that Goyer's no longer the writer. Christopher Nolan is no longer appearing, as far as a name attached to the project, Emma Thompson as well. Things are interesting. Things are heating up in the world of the Man of Steel, Superman, Batman crossover. It's kind of interesting. I don't know what this will bode, but the article does close by saying that what does this mean as the film progresses? Well, it's still early in the game, but keep in mind that there are several Oscar nominees and winners involved in this project. So all hope is not lost, but it's kind of interesting that it is definitely changing this much. It's lost a lot of name recognition, and it's lost its writer, more or less.
But it still has Gal Gadot, though.
Indeed. Indeed. It can Gal Gadot its way home. That's for sure. All right. Next up. From Collider.com, courtesy of Christina Radish, Joel Kinnaman talks RoboCop reboot, and basically he's going on and on about how great it is and everything. However, he is on the record as stating, quote, "I sincerely hope they're going for R, because I can't imagine how RoboCop could be PG-13. That would be a huge mistake. If I have any say in it, I will fight very hard for it. It has to be violent. And I couldn't agree more. This would be a terrible, terrible mistake to make the new RoboCop movie a PG-13 affair. There are just certain movies that need an R. And not because it's
like Dread.
Gotta be bad. But I mean, yeah, like Dread. It's just the subject matter. It's just the way that it goes. Could you imagine if Goodfellas had been PG-13? You know what I mean?
Oh, man. What's his name could even be in it?
Any of them couldn't have been in it.
But mainly, what's his name?
Joe Pesci?
Yeah, motherfucker. Yeah.
I'm funny. Funny how? Am I ha-ha funny? Am I fucking clown? Am I here for your fucking amusement? Do I fucking amuse you? No, I just mean you're funny. but funny how? So, yeah, there's just no way that you could have that. It's terrible. Terrible, terrible, terrible.
Well, it's PG-13, unfortunately.
Ugh. Well, then I guess he didn't work too hard. Seriously, that's terrible. I don't know. They might be able to come up with an R-rated cut.
There'll be still a not director's cut.
I mean, yeah, it still hasn't released.
Yeah.
They might have some they can go to the MPAA with at the last minute. Next up for me, coming from Deadline.com, courtesy of Mike Fleming Jr., Liam Neeson to star in Martin Scorsese's Silence. That's right. He's going to be starring with Andrew Garfield.
Is he hunting
Garfield.
Somebody down in this movie?
I don't know.
Is
They're
he avenging his daughter or wife's kidnapping?
Is he scheduled to reprise his role in Taken 3.
Oh, God.
Silence. It's interesting that you bring that up. See, Neeson is scheduled to reprise his role in Taken 3, but while Neeson has remade himself as an action star, Silence brings him back to the kind of work he did in Schindler's List and in the Scorsese-directed Gangs of New York. The film is produced by Erwin Winkler, Randall Emmett and George Furla, Emma Tingler, oh my gosh, there's a whole host of people. This is pretty cool. Yeah, basically, Silence. The movie Silence is the Martin Scorsese-directed adaptation of Shusaku Endo's novel about 17th century Jesuits who tried to bring Christianity to isolated Japan. So, yeah. And I think it's interesting how he stars with Andrew Garfield and Ken Watanabe. Oh. This is good. So I really think this is going to be a pretty kick-ass flick. I'm definitely down for it. But yeah, you interrupted me. You brought it up. So yes, now you have to force yourself to know to go through the rest of your life knowing that there's going to be a Taken 3.
Great. And I won't see that one either. And I will be the only one that didn't like that one either. There you go.
Sounds like Matt might get a little bit of reprisal for some movie that I'm going to be seeing relatively soon.
Yes.
Oh, gosh. It's going to be so much fun. What I'm going to do to you.
It's okay. Still have Nymphomaniac Parts 1 and 2. And
that means I got two movies, bro. That means I get two movies to make you see. Ah. Man, we've waited all... Well, I guess that would work since we waited all year and didn't do anything last year. Now both of us have got two movies each that we're going to be doing. So, yeah, that's good. All right, let's see here. Also have from comicbookresources.com here, Mark Webb reveals BJ Novak's Amazing Spider-Man 2 role, which is going to be a Smythe. Likely confirmation that Novak is playing Alistair Smythe, a long-running character in the Spidey mythos. Over the course of the story, for anybody who really is going to care about this, Alistair's character, the role that he plays, is someone who actually ends up becoming the ultimate Spider Slayer. So they could very well be planting seeds for the future movie. So anybody who cares about BJ Novak and what he's doing, well, now you know what he's
doing. Well, they also casted Mark Strong and Jesse Eisenberg. He's going to be Lex Luthor, surprisingly.
Yeah, that's really kind of weird.
Oh, that's in the Superman movie, not Spider-Man.
Yeah, I was going to say that's...
Whoops.
Yeah. Roger Ebert's Widow. This is coming from IndieWire.com, courtesy of Nigel M. Smith. Roger Ebert's Widow reveals that the critic wanted Philip Seymour Hoffman to play him in a film. And this is just to sum it up. Quote, "Yesterday was hard when I heard about Philip Seymour Hoffman." This is, of course, Chaz Ebert talking about him. And this was in relation to Life itself, the premiere of the documentary about Roger Ebert's life. And she said, quote, "Yesterday was hard when I heard about Philip Seymour Hoffman's death. Roger would say he's one of the best, most versatile actors ever. And he was also a brilliant man, you know, human being, just very smart. And so Roger always said, if you ever do a movie where you need someone to play me, I want Philip Seymour Hoffman." End quote. And I just think that's kind of sad because what are they going to do about stuff that he was doing? Now look at what is unfortunately never going to be done.
Yeah.
Last but not least for me is an article that I know that I saved for last purposely because I know that Tim wants to talk about it too. This is one of our little crossovers that we scour the web and we go to different websites and then we do have favorites and so we rely on some more than others, but I'm generally genuinely surprised at how very little crossover there is. And in this particular instance, I was not surprised that we both had this. And this comes to us from Gizmodo.com, courtesy of Jeff Manaw. "How LED streetlights will change cinema and make cities look awesome." And this comes from a decision by the city of Los Angeles last year to replace the original high-pressure sodium streetlights, which give LA one of its distinctive views, which is at night, something that they note in this article that Tim noted last week for the 3 Squared in Collateral, which makes such good use of the lighting at night, is now changing to blue-tinted LEDs. And it literally changes the look. They have before and after shots of what the LEDs are looking like as compared to the original shots. And to the credit of the LEDs, the shots look so much crisper. Yes, you lose it is true. You lose this distinctive yellow hue that you will notice time and time again from movies, from TV shows, from even just regular reporting, people who live there and just have looked at how things, you know, taken for granted, just this is how things look.
Yeah, you miss out on the nighttime smog with the LED lights.
But I mean, the level of definition that you can see in between these changes is unreal. They have one shot. It's the third set of before and afters that shows this kind of an alley. But basically, it's just the same shot of a street taken at night, one with the original sodium lights and the other with the LEDs. And I look at the before picture and it's like, wow, this is just like every picture I've ever seen of LA. And then I look down at the after and I'm like, I literally think that I'm watching a shot from a movie, from like a J.J. Abrams movie, where you can see it's just kind of coming in at sunset. And the level of definition is unreal. But this, it definitely is interesting because the article does touch on something that is so important. And it kind of makes me wonder, especially in a town like LA, how this didn't happen. The switch, they talk about in the article how the switch to LED really is a historic change for the visual definition of Los Angeles. So much so, the author is arguing that we might someday find ourselves seriously arguing over whether a city's artificial lights, due to their unique color scheme, could be justifiably subject to historic preservation laws. And I don't know that that necessarily needs to be the case. And there was an argument also made that, oh, well, you can do anything you want with digital and Photoshop. But apparently, because of the way LED works, you cannot add color that wasn't already there. So the idea that you can make them all pop the original yellow tint is not as easy done.
Sure, first you print it on film, you whip out your junk, and well, after you eat a lot of asparagus, and you just take a giant leak all over it, because this yellow hue looks like we're living in a urine stain. Everything
well,
is
and,
soaked.
And I think
pee.
It's a great change. I really think it's going to be a great change.
Yeah.
And I think that it's going to actually improve film quality, not hurt it.
Yeah.
But I don't know. So what is your take on this? I think this is a great change. I think the before and after shots clearly show just how amazing the new color scheme is. And I think it's going to really help film overall, especially where I think it's going to add a whole new layer to the film versus digital debate. And not because of, oh, I want to make my color yellow versus the LED blue tint. I really think that with color saturations and the way things that they shoot and the resolutions of digital versus film, I think these new LED lights are going to allow a whole new layer of depth to people who like to use film that hasn't been available to them before.
Yeah, I think so too. I think mainly on the indie film level, I think it's not going to really make a big difference with the broader films and filmmakers and whatnot, considering how a lot of that stuff isn't even shot in LA anymore. So, but I think I like the LEDs a lot. I mean, you look at it and, oh, look, you can substitute an LA street for a New York street, finally. You know, without it being, oh, hey, it looks like I'm standing in a street soaked in pee. It actually looks like, oh, I'm actually standing on a blacktop, some cement.
That's awesome.
Yeah, but it's nice. It's really neat.
Well, right on, man. Right on. Okay, so then I guess it is time for our first ever I'm the Only One Who Hated It.
Oh, do we have to come up with a theme song for this?
I kind of have an idea for...
Were you, composing this? Were you composing a theme
I was
song
not
for
composing.
A segment we've never done?
I was not composing, per se, as much as I was...
Taking a dump and thinking about it? Close?
No, I was thinking about doing a parody. It's about as close to a Rush Limbaugh impersonation as I'm going to get. He apparently, my mother says that he does this. I've never really noticed. He apparently flips paper a lot in his formerly nicotine-stained fingers. And he does that a lot. So that's about as close to that as I'm ever going to get.
Rush.
Feel the rush. No, I actually thought about having a... did you ever hear the song Stupefied? By the band, I think the band was called Disturbed.
Yes.
Let's see here. I'm trying to remember. I was trying to plan it ahead, and then I got sidetracked, and I wanted to actually listen to the chorus of the song. Or I think that a perfect thing for this one would just be quoting Will Ferrell's Mugatu character.
Okay, that's the easiest, and will take less time.
Shut up! Blue Steel, Ferrari, La Tigra, they're the same face! Doesn't anyone notice this? I feel like I'm taking crazy pills! I invented the piano key necktie!
All right, so here we are. I am the only one who hated it. Okay, now again, for our first foray into this, we want to try and make it as easy as possible. And in doing so, I said, I think we agreed the rules would be, it could be a critical success and or a financial success. And this way, we could open it up to movies that maybe had done better on video or now have huge cult followings now or are considered classics, even though maybe they didn't do as well in the theaters. Is that a pretty good criteria for this particular foray, just to see if we like it or not?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Would you like to go first, or do you want me to go first?
I can go first.
All right, lay it on us, sir. Which is the movie that you are the only one who hates it?
Unfortunately, I chose a movie that is not only a critical success, but as well as a box office success. And there are...
Last episode that we're ever going to do, because... He sent me his pick, and I hate him now, and I can't work with him anymore.
And I first off, I will say that I did the noble thing, and since I haven't seen the movie, since I saw it at the movie theater, I went back today and rewatched it, skipping past the parts that really bug me, and I enjoyed the movie a lot more without the first 15 minutes of the movie. And with that being said, it is the Disney film Up, which came out in 2009, and we all know the story. The old man who recently lost his wife very depressingly, that you had this 15 minutes of build-up, and it's the most depressing thing ever. And his house, these people want to tear down his house, and they want to put him in a old folks home, and he doesn't want that, so he attaches all these balloons to his house, and he floats up, and he wants to visit Paradise Falls, which is a location where him and his wife have always planned on vacationing to. It's just they never actually made it, so this was his last thing that he wanted to do in memory of her. And along the way, this little fat kid, I forget his name, ends up tagging along, and he has troubles, family issues on his own. Cute kid, sweet kid. He's a Boy Scout, so he's always trying hard to succeed. Unfortunately, he doesn't really succeed. But he does well in his own way. If you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. So then they go on this journey. Now, okay, I appreciate the movie for being, I would say, the heaviest Disney Pixar movie or Disney movie I've ever seen. More modern Disney movie. Fox and the Hound to me is still the most depressing Disney movie, but I love the Fox and the Hound. But the ending of that movie where they accept death, you know, that had me going, because I actually thought that there was the possibility that they were going to die, you know, that they were all just going to burn. It was just a tragic ending, but that worked in the movie, and I'll get to that stuff in a little bit. However, Up starts with the sweet, and it tricks you into a utterly depressing situation between him and his wife when his wife dies. And I'm not shitting you. I mean, this is the first 12 or 15 minutes of the movie. I'm not joking. The first 12 or 15 minutes of the movie, they show you whenever they're little, and I think this is what gets me, is that it doesn't just show them when they're adults together and then she passes away, but it starts off when they're really little and they meet, and they've been not just high school sweethearts, but like toddler sweethearts or elementary school sweethearts or whatever, and it tracks their relationship up until in their old age when she ends up passing away. And I don't care what Disney movie it is, what animated movie it is, that hit a nerve with me. And it could have been some of the family issues I was dealing with at the time. It could have been other stuff I was dealing with at the time. But I just couldn't get past that moment. And in its own way, it's effective. And I do commend Disney, John Lasseter and all those guys, Peter Docter, who I think was the one that directed it, for creating that feeling. But I wish it was carried on through effectively, you know, throughout the entire movie. And I wish it was used throughout the movie without it feeling like I was being cheated in a way. And I mean cheated is because since this is a Disney movie, they have to add in all the silly kid stuff or the silly Disney stuff. And it's not, to me, it wasn't the silly kid stuff like you, the Disney humor like you see in like Monsters Incorporated or Toy Story. And granted, I know it's a different kind of humor because a lot of the humor comes from the animals and the little boy, the Boy Scout who drags along. But still, it seems like a lot of the stuff, the humor was more cliche and more cliche, and it just wasn't funny to me. So I didn't have that comedic break from all of the sadness. And I think a particular movie like this, it needs to have that effective comedic break. And there's a lot of people that, I don't want to say fell for it, but obviously most people dug it and got in, you know, was along with it. I don't know if it was because they were so depressed by the end of the movie, they were willing to accept any comedy whatsoever and roll with it. And this is definitely one of those movies that if you don't get a strong grasp on it within the first half hour or within the first 15-20 minutes of it, then you're kind of you're going to be set in your ways throughout the entire movie. And again, I mean, it's, you know, I know most of the people that are going to listen to this are going to think I'm Satan for spreading this evil gospel of how I do not like Disney's Up. But it's the truth. I don't. The reason why the ending of Toy Story, why to me that felt more, not human, but I could kind of like connect with it and I was kind of drawn into the movie, is because the movie right off the bat didn't start off as depressing. It started off as Toy Story. And how, like, a lot of what I love about, like, Monsters Incorporated and other Disney movies, Finding Nemo, even, where it's, you watch it, you're captivated by beautiful visuals, you have these excellent characters, you have a spectacular story, you're taken on this wonderful, beautiful journey, and then suddenly, sometimes, you're hit with emotion, like, real, raw, you know, human emotion that you can't imagine that, you know, you can be getting from a kid's movie. But I tell you know, I did. I got it. It's because it happened at the end, not at the beginning of it. It had something to build up to. And like those movies, I thought Up substituted the goofy humor and the emotion for the intensity that I thought it needed to really build up to its final moments. And to me, the movie doesn't ever really take off. The movie is about the journey. Not only, I understand now that it's not just about the tropical journey that him and the boy go on, but it's also a self journey that him and the boy go on for. It's a journey to find themselves, to find out who each other are and to become better people, for him to become a better person, the old man, that is. But even with that, I feel that it doesn't commit completely to one side of the spectrum. It's not fully committing to the fun Disney movie, and it's not fully committing to the dramatic aspect to it. But then when I look at it in a different way, they had the idea of making something so heavy and kind of trying to blend it with the Disney quality, you know, or a heavier Disney Pixar movie. I appreciate it. But yet, again, it didn't have a consistent effect that I really, really wanted. And again, it doesn't really take off from the constant emotional, you know, depressing undertones. I don't get the feeling that they're on an adventure. More things start to happen when they're not, stuff isn't really reminiscing about, you know, him being upset and there's more character growth and all that stuff. There's a lot of suspension of belief to be had for the drama to really carry on. You know, like he has so much stock in this house, yet this house is being carried over by balloons and all this stuff. And yes, again, I mean, there doesn't have to be like a logical reason for all this stuff. But it just, and again, this falls into one side, one thing or another, the comedy camp family Disney movie or the emotional drama. Like which one, I don't want to say which one doesn't want to be period, but which one wants to take precedent? It's like they have all this emotional peril that's going on, but how about the real peril that they're in? It's like the big fight on the dirigible, It's like, well, I don't have to worry about the kid dying because, well, you know, he's on the balloon and he's kind of floating around with a fire extinguisher moving along. And just kind of stuff like that. It just didn't mesh well with me. I didn't hate the movie. Didn't hate it. I just disliked it. I didn't care for it as much as a lot of other people did. And trust me, with people that absolutely love Disney, people want to argue with me about this movie. This movie and Brave, especially Brave. Man, there is a lot. It's a 2.5-star movie for me. So, I mean, that is the reason why I was the only one that didn't like Disney Pixar's Up.
Truly, you have a dizzying intellect.
So, A Star is Born. That's my movie. I hated this movie. Okay, this is not particularly well received by critics. It has currently a 31% rotten rating, which means at least some critics enjoyed it, but the vast majority did not. Roger Ebert actually gave this film 2.5 stars, so he just kind of, he thought it was an okay movie, basically, a little bit better than okay. However, this movie did make over $80 million, so people really liked it. And I think people really liked it on the strength of the music, because it's Barbra Streisand. And even Kris Kristofferson was also very popular as a musician during this time period. Basically, this is a remake. It's actually the second remake. There's a 1937 version that was a drama, and then there was a 1954 version that was a musical. The original drama had Janet Gaynor and Frederick March, where the musical was Judy Garland and James Mason. And I'm sorry, I'm not... It's been 37 years now, so you guys should have seen this movie if you're going to see it. Basically, chick meets a dude. The chick is a nobody. Dude is a famous performer. In this case, it's music, so he's a famous musician. He's on the downswing, but he really works hard to get her discovered and get her made, and then she becomes a superstar, and he's a self-destructive alcoholic, so he ends up offing himself, thinking that she'll be better off without him, but of course, she doesn't want to go on without him and has to be made to go on without him. This is the plot, this is the overlying plot of all three movies. The 1937 drama is the best. The 1954 version is very, very good. And this one sucks donkey dick through a straw. I can't tell you, it's just not good. It is everything that was wrong with the 70s put to music. And I'm not talking about disco, and it's just the way that the way that people acted, the way that people saw musicals and stuff then, this was just not the way to bring about a resurgence in musicals to go to the movies. There's a reason why, after movies like this, musicals basically died out up until Chicago back in like 2002. There's so many things for me technically wrong. It's just hard for me to believe that you could have Kris Kristofferson's character. Semi-autobiographical for him, because he really was an alcoholic and stuff, and he really did have a lot of problems and pretty much walked away from his family and stuff. But there are just so many different aspects of this movie with the way the acting rolls out. I didn't like the cinematography of this particular movie. The story seems so completely over the top. Again, it's a musical, but this is kind of the... I don't know. It's just weird, and I don't like the flow. This is a very awkwardly set movie. This is basically Barbra Streisand saying, look at me, I'm Barbra Streisand, I can do whatever I want. Back in 1976. So go figure. I didn't like this movie at all. This is definitely a 1-star movie for me. I hated it. And judging by the general public's reaction, I am the only one who hated it. And that is my film. All right. Guess that brings us to the movies! All right, we are doing the animated films that have been nominated for an Oscar. This is the best animated film. The films up are Frozen, The Croods, Despicable Me 2, and Ernest and Celestine. Now, of course, there is Miyamoto's film, The Wind... what's it called?
Rises.
The Wind. Thank you. The Wind Rises, which... despite our best efforts and all of the connections that we have in Hollywood, which I guess is zero, but you're not supposed to know that, we could not get an advanced screening of this film. And it comes out on the... This doesn't come out Friday, right? For us?
I think it's the last Friday of February.
Okay, I thought it was the 7th. But it, yeah, there you go. So it would be the 27th, basically. So we're not going to be able to review that one, unfortunately. Okay, I reviewed Frozen back when it came out in November. My review stands on that.
What'd you rate it again? I know it wasn't 5 stars. I just don't remember if it was like a 4 point something.
Yeah, it was either 4 or 4.5 stars. Okay. All right, so we're going to start off with Frozen on this one, guys. Basically, Frozen... was a fantastic movie for me. I can't recall off the top of my head if it was like 4 or 4.5 stars, but I really, really thoroughly enjoyed the movie. So, Tim, what did you think, sir?
I didn't enjoy it as much. I, in fact... Man, it's pick on Disney. They invited me to their home. To the birthplace of Disney. Well, not the birthplace of Disney, but... You know, to the home of Disney, Disneyland, and yet I am... taking a crap on their movies. But Frozen, to me, it was a... Oh, man. It was a 2.5 out of 5-star movie for me. It was too much High School Musical for me. In taste, it was too much High School Musical. That is concerning the execution of the songs. None of them really stood out. And yeah, this is... The first half of this movie is definitely a full-blown musical. And I really didn't start getting into the movie until the second half, when there wasn't any of the music. And I think it came down to that the songs in the movie just really took me out of the movie, because it kind of felt like that the songs were an afterthought. They had like the idea of, okay, well, it's going to be a beautiful movie with great landscapes, scenic views. It's going to have a great kind of like character... a twist at the end of the movie, and an effective character twist at the end of the movie, I'll add, as well as it's going to have a good message to the movie. And I like those. I like that aspect of the movie, and there were definitely some really cool shots and really neat scenery and effects and whatnot that I liked, and again, you know, plot elements that I did enjoy. But really, it's the cliche song and the cliche Disney princess story elements that really honestly got to me. I've grunted a lot at this while watching this movie, because you have the goofy, the reindeer with a personality. Well, I mean, you've had 4 or 5 other Disney movies where there's been a hoofed animal of some sort with a personality that doesn't speak. And... you know, and I like the non-prince guy. You know, I thought he was a pretty decent character, but not enough to really. I mean, obviously not enough to carry the movie, since the movie is really. I mean, at the heart of the movie, it's the relationship between the queen and the princess. And you always know when the songs are gonna take place and when they're gonna be gone, and when they're gonna begin. Songs are forced and very random. They felt like an afterthought again. I didn't think the story really needed it. It's just like, oh, I'm gonna sing about, like, literally they say the same word over and over and over again in a number of these songs. I'm not joking. They say the same thing over and over again. And it's, again, that's the High School Musical thing for me. And I guess that's even contemporary musicals, even on Broadway. I ranted about that in a past episode. And though some of the settings were gorgeous and breathtaking, they had great snow, the artistry of the snow and the placement of like everything in the shot in the frame. I thought there were just many bland kind of like scene moments. I thought like the character movement contradicted the camera movements, because unlike the Croods, which we'll be talking about that in a little bit, I loved how the camera movement and kind of matched the character movement. So like whenever the characters were really animated, the camera was kind of like taking you, was moving around and taking you into that world. And with this movie, I noticed that they were trying to be a little bit more classic Disney. But if you want to be classic Disney, I mean, I just think they just needed to commit to classic Disney. But yeah, but yet, they, I mean, the characters themselves are very animated and, you know, they can jump up and, you know, do all these impossible movements. But yeah, 2.5 out of 5 stars.
All right, next up here, we'll do Despicable Me 2. This was something we also covered last year, over the summer. What'd you say mine was? 3.75?
Yeah, 3.75. Mine was 3, and I think the general consensus was it was predictable, but it had fantastic visuals, animation. Other than there being some great gags, the plot was simple, and there really wasn't a point to there being a sequel.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically a very simple film. Nothing too special about the film in and of itself, but it was just very well done.
Yes.
And enjoyable. All right, so good. So that takes care of those two. Let's see here. Let's do Ernest and Celestine next. That is the French one that then, of course, is redubbed for U.S. audiences, obviously, about a mouse and a bear that form an unlikely friendship and what it really means to simply be unlikely allies and how they and how you can change perceptions based on even when you can't it, whether or not you change perceptions, you can still have the kinds of friendships that you want to have in life. Me, this is definitely a 3.5-star movie for me. Yeah, it was well done. Not super huge fan of the animation in this film, but that's just because of the style. It has nothing to do with any flaws in the animation or anything. Just not my particular cup of tea. So that kind of made it a little... It was very storybookish. It was kind of like watching Caillou or Thomas the... Not even Thomas, no, that's the wrong one. Like Caillou or something else where they kind of fade the edges of the screen almost like you're reading out of a storybook. And that's fun for the short term, but not for a full-length animated film, in my opinion. The story, however, is where the heart of this movie is. Great story, lots of really interesting characters, and even though the plot is somewhat predictable, I still thought that the story that it told was very heartwarming and just something that a lot of people can relate to, especially when you find yourself as an outlier in society or an outcast for whatever reason. And not necessarily an outcast like you've done something wrong, but just when you're, for whatever reason, you find yourself outside the social circles. You're almost like a social misfit. And I think that that's what kind of made that story so much fun for me. 3.5 stars.
Yeah, not much I can really add to it. I'm going to give it 3.5 to 4 stars, but I think I'm going to stand firm on 3.5. I like the animation for the most part. I think the movie really comes together at the middle and going on, you know, bridging the middle to the end of the film when the characters are fully developed and you see it, how much they actually really mean to each other. And they do something very interesting where they start, at least one of them starts like second guessing the friendship. And I thought the editing, the back and forth style kind of editing in the courthouses was pretty interesting. And yeah, you know, there are various messages one can take from this movie. And I appreciate it. I'm glad that it has the recognition that it's been receiving. So yeah, I give it a 3.5 out of 5-star rating as well.
Well, then to wrap it up, we're going to do The Croods. And this, of course, is the 2013 American 3D computer animated film. This was done by Fox and DreamWorks. And this is about the family of cavemen who run across a new guy, basically, who is more advanced. He's kind of like, he knows how to work fire. He kind of understands the idea behind clothes and stuff. And these are people, you know, the family is just a cave family trapped in a cave and just trying subsistence living, basically. And of course, they have a big, huge adventure while they're trying to find a new home because there are earthquakes and everything that are destroying the place where they live. This movie, this is a 3-star. 3.5. I'll be, you know what? No, I'm going to split the difference. 3.25 stars on this one. It's a good movie, but it takes a while for it to get going. And something that I really like about Pixar that I think they do well, even in movies like Up, and something that I think Disney does well, even in movies like Frozen, but Pixar is definitely better than this. Sorry, I just had to pick on Tim a little bit. Is how they use things and they give kind of a clever life to them, or they do things that are very clever. In Ratatouille, how they scavenge for food, but there's one gourmand among them. Or in Toy Story, how the toys actually interact with one another, and then how they utilize the toys in fun and interesting ways. Where here, they just kind of go for the easy thing. You know, you've got a dog, you've got a kid that acts like a dog. There's this really elongated scene at the beginning where they go and search for food, and it's just all done. They kind of run half apish, half, you know, and so they're kind of establishing that these people are cave people and everything, which is fine, but at the same time it's just kind of blasé. But then they finally get going, and there's a lot of stuff with father daughter in here, and as a guy who's got 3 daughters, it kind of hit home for me a little bit more than others, and than maybe it will for others. But overall, the story is a nice story. It's a very family-oriented story, but they kind of trip over themselves with the gimmickry. And while it does lessen as the movie goes on, they do still rely on it at certain points. So I give this one 3.25 stars, and that's where I went on this one.
Right off the bat, right when the camera jets out of the cave and following the dad, it had me hooked completely. Because as I was talking about Frozen before, where it seemed like the characters were all moving around like animated-like, but the camera was just still kind of like the classic, you know, set camera. This one was moving around with them. It made everything more inviting to me, to where I was thrown into the adventure and thrown into the excitement of the movie, that it was all kind of like drumming up for the entertainment. I definitely thought this was the most entertaining out of the 4 nominated movies that we've seen. But I will say that I thought Nick Cage seemed miscast at first, but luckily as the movie goes on, I don't know, it's weird, it's interesting, but he ends up becoming more loose and has a little more fun with the character and plays around with the voice a little bit, and it's, in a way, it's kind of noticeable. So that took a little bit off there. Let's see, I liked how that the sappy moments, and there are some sappy kind of humanistic, I guess, moments in a way. The sappy moments aren't overworked at all, and they're not out of place. And I actually cared for these guys during certain moments, especially the father-daughter stuff and the father and being head of the family and trying to do better and figure out why, you know, just growing, completely growing. And it's just, you know, it's I think it says something when you're watching a movie that is pretty ridiculous when you're just looking at it. And in some way that you can connect to it, and it succeeded in that way. Even if it was just for, you know, sporadic bits throughout the movie, mainly from the middle to the end. However, a big criticism is that it obviously, and this again ties in a little bit with what Matt was saying, the movie obviously tries too hard to make obvious comparisons between the Stone Age and modern times. You know, it makes the obvious and cliche comparisons. You know, like they'll act like cave people, cavemen or whatever. But then they'll say, oh man, well, and then they'll make some kind of like pop culture reference, or, you know, make more of a modern contemporary reference. But yet then they'll play dumb again. And it's just kind of like, stick with one thing or another. I hate the flip-flop, you know, that they do for the sake of getting a laugh in many of these kids movies. However, I will say that I think this was some of the best animation that I have seen in a while in an animated movie, and I think honestly maybe since Rango from a few years ago, that it was just created just these stunning realistic elements and colors. The rocks look like real rocks. You can see the minerals, and you can see the dust and the dirt whenever they run past it or they launch themselves off it. It's very impressive. And again, that added to the drawing me in effect. And I guess it had more of an impact on me than really, I guess, like that kind of like overshadowed the story flaws and even some of the really, you know, goofy character stuff that was going on. So this to me was a 4 out of 5 star movie.
Did you make any comparisons with this movie and Captain Ron? Because I did. I was just kind of curious.
No, but you know what? I completely forgot about Captain Ron. That's with
I don't know. I just
Douglas,
see a,
right?
I just see a lot of when I see it, especially with the whole you know, I have crazy ideas thing where he keeps trying to come up with, you know, fun ideas and stuff. I just see a lot of that, and then Captain Ron, I'm seeing a lot of parallels there. Anyways, all right, well, I guess then that's going to be all for this week, and next week, of course, as I said before, we're going to do a 3Squared/discussion mashup there to discuss a little bit more in depth the life and times of Philip Seymour Hoffman. And then, of course, our 3 favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman films. The movies for next week, we're going to cover some of those Oscar-nominated foreign flicks, including The Hunt, The Broken Circle Breakdown, and The Great Beauty. And then, of course, because we don't want to forget about actual movies, we're going to be covering The Monuments Men as well. And that's something that I've been looking forward to for a while. And I guess that's about it, unless there's anything else for you, sir?
No, I believe that's it.
All right, then let us do the spiel.
Spiel on.
All right, the music you've been listening to, as always, has been provided to us by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com. You can also check them out at myspace.com, facebook.com, and reverbnation.com/criesofsolace. We, of course, are still the SLS Cast, and you can check us out at slscast.com. You can also check us out on Twitter at the SLS Cast. Send us an email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can go to Facebook and, of course, search the SLS Cast there, as well as subscribe to us on iTunes or favorite us now on Stitcher Radio. And remember, it's not just because you can go online, that's even an app for all you Android people like me. And it works wonders, let me tell you.
Even a car app. Also, apparently.
That's right. Car app, it's great. So check out. Do the Stitcher thing. Stitcher's fun. And I guess until next time, this is Matt saying that thanks to Moira Kelly, I get to say this. Money's not important to me. Movie star acknowledgement is not important to me. I don't want to be a big studio actress. I don't want to be in the limelight.
Who doesn't? Alrighty, guys. Take care. See you next week.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.
Hey, I'll let this helicopter go by. Vietnam.